Congress had a solid understanding of what the Navy was building over the next half decade. The department updates and submits this information annually. The theatrics coming from some congressional representatives over my decision to delay the plan's submission was simply the politics they played to their base and the money this industry brought. To some, this was about jobs and re-election, not strategy or building the best Navy possible. I planned to submit the 30-year shipbuilding plan, but given the NDS and our focus on China, I felt it was more important to get the plan right than get something to Congress on time. In December 2017, the Navy released a future force structure goal that called for building and maintaining a fleet of 355 ships. The service completed this assessment in 2016, well before the NDS was developed. Critics of the plan said that the 355-ship goal supported the Admiralty's desire for a 12-carrier fleet, with a battle force built to protect and support them. Therefore, they took the number of other vessels required to enable one carrier, multiplied it by 12, added a few other ships that didn't fit neatly into the number, and voila, out came 355. That explanation is probably too simple and too cynical, though I had watched the Army do something similar with its 10-division force in the mid-1990s. Nonetheless, members of Congress representing shipbuilding interests decided to make that force goal the law in December 2017, and they reinforced it in 2018 with another statute mandating no fewer than 11 aircraft carriers in the fleet. The system was taking care of the key stakeholders and itself. I began raising questions about force structure and readiness with the Navy early in my tenure, as we tried to maintain enough carriers in the right place, at the right time, for the right duration. The precipitating event was the delayed departure of the USS Harry Truman from Norfolk, Virginia, in August 2019. An electrical malfunction prevented the aircraft carrier from getting to sea for 3 months, which caused me to extend the USS Abraham Lincoln's stay in the Middle East, which prompted another set of compounding readiness and maintenance concerns. The Navy was in a bad place when it came to readiness. On any given day, about one-third of the roughly 300-ship fleet was at sea, which was impressive given their challenges, but the trend lines weren't good. The Government Accountability Office, GAO, reported in 2017 that ship conditions continued to decline and readiness had worsened. The Navy was burning down future readiness to meet the current demands of the combatant commanders. The operational geographic commanders of CENTCOM and EUCOM, for example, wanted these ships on patrol in their areas of responsibility to support operations. More importantly, they wanted to send a message to our adversaries about the reach and capabilities of the U.S. military. I respected what the Navy was doing, but maintaining such a pace was not sustainable, and the future fleet would end up paying the bill. However, the combatant commanders didn't bear all the blame for the Navy's readiness problems. The service had made several bad decisions too, such as reducing crew sizes, which resulted in fewer sailors available to do maintenance at sea, thus necessitating longer in-port repairs, not ordering enough spare parts, and failing to build training into some ships' schedules. A follow-up report by the GAO in 2019 suggested the problems were worsening. Fixing all the issues would take billions of dollars and many years. Aircraft carriers, the crown jewels of the fleet, were in a category all by themselves. During most of my tenure, the Navy could only deploy 2 carriers out of 11 simultaneously. At some points, there were none at sea, which was risky and irresponsible, and on a few rare occasions, there were 3 or more. I would readily give up having 3 at sea if it meant never hitting zero again. Given the total number of carriers in the inventory, we should have 3 on station most months out of the year, but the best the Navy could really sustain was 2. After going through another few weeks with no carriers deployed, I told Admiral Mike Gilday, the Chief of Naval Operations, CNO, in the summer of 2020, to plan on 2 carriers deployed all the time. This would be the new policy, and they needed to figure out a way to make it happen without hurting current or future readiness. I would do my part by continuing to challenge the combatant commander's requests. The Navy Secretary, CNO, and I discussed this often. I knew a continuous two-carrier presence wouldn't be achievable anytime soon given the maintenance schedules, but I didn't want my successors to go through what I did. Extended periods of scheduled maintenance and months-long workup blocks for the carrier crews and aviation drove much of the challenge with these ships. U.S. Navy aircraft carriers are incredibly impressive, can project American power abroad, and are probably the most lethal weapon system afloat. But I wasn't convinced that for the amount of money the nation poured into them, we were getting a high enough return on investment. I certainly wasn't convinced they would survive in a war fight against China the way the admirals envisioned their employment. The other challenge was the opportunity cost of investing in a carrier versus other platforms, particularly when the department is facing budgetary headwinds. The USS Gerald R. Ford, the first in a new class of aircraft carriers, will cost nearly $14 billion based on current estimates, and up to $20 billion with everything it needed to go to war, such as its embarked air wing, and take at least 14 years to build by the time it's complete and fully ready to deploy. With that same amount of time and funding, the Navy could build up to 4 Virginia-class attack submarines. Importantly, the sub will spend more time at sea over its lifetime, is less vulnerable to the enemy, and can deliver lethal effects with near impunity. After a hearing before the House Armed Services Committee on February 27, 2020, and some drama in Congress over my decision regarding the shipbuilding plan, Acting Navy Secretary Thomas Modley came to brief me on the final Integrated Naval Force Structure Assessment, INFSA, which was the Navy's plan for its future fleet. Tom, a 1983 graduate of the Naval Academy, became Undersecretary of the Navy in December 2017. He spent 7 years on active duty as a helicopter pilot, a couple of decades in the private sector, and took over as acting secretary in November 2019. Tom was good with the numbers and called things the way he saw them. Despite all the work, I saw nothing bold in the Navy's plan, and not enough of what my OSD experts and external think tanks thought was important to deal with a future China. The INFSA was still built around the myopic 12-carrier paradigm, despite both Modley and former Navy Secretary Richard Spencer privately expressing their concerns about the carrier's cost and utility in a China fight. Modley thought we should have fewer carriers, which would free up billions of dollars for other needed ships. Spencer had taken a similar approach. He pushed hard for so-called light carriers, where existing marine amphibious ships were loaded solely with F-35 stealth fighters and able to deliver an aerial punch from the sea. Both secretaries were on the right path, but faced resistance from the uniformed side and select members of the Armed Services Committees. It seemed to all of us that the Admiralty and certain members of Congress were as attached to the aircraft carrier in 2020 as their predecessors had been to the battleship prior to World War II. This phenomenon was not unique to the Navy. Each of the services had their cultural fixations that prevented them from preparing to fight the next war. However, the amount of money and effort the Navy poured into a carrier-centric fleet at the opportunity cost of so many other things, coupled with their growing vulnerability, was the quiet complaint whispered to me by many other members of Congress, think tank experts, and former Pentagon officials. Regardless, Modley endorsed the plan, proudly stating that the CNO and the Marine Corps Commandant developed it, and did so without involvement by the Secretary of the Navy. That was strange, I thought. I knew where Tom stood on the carriers and other key parts of the report, so why endorse this plan? Moreover, what was the purpose of civilian leadership if they weren't going to get involved with something as important as the future of their service? Tom was candid about something everybody knew. The Navy's plan to build a 355-ship fleet by 2030 was not budget-informed, and equally important, industry and the shipyards could not logistically support it. He would press for an additional $5 to $7 billion annually, and I would push back, asking from where I should take that money. All the services needed more funding to modernize, and we had to build out space, cyberspace, and other things first on top of that. At least the Army and Air Force were scrubbing their budgets to free up funding. I saw little of that from the Sea Service, so I wasn't about to reward bad behavior simply because the Navy didn't want to make hard choices. That was the onus I put on Modley, and to his credit, He jumped on it. Not surprisingly, the Navy's proponents, inside and outside the building, took up the charge that the Navy needed more of the budget pie. They felt they were receiving the smallest share. Plus, they argued, the China fight was a maritime one. Both points were incorrect. According to the Pentagon comptroller, the Navy was receiving more funding than any other service, and even then was only spending 11% of their $205 billion annual budget on shipbuilding. Having gone through the night court process with the Army, I knew that if the Navy leadership could all get on the same page, they could find the additional money. The new incoming secretary, Ken Braithwaite, a former Navy aviator and retired Rear Admiral turned business executive whom the Senate confirmed in May 2020, would do just that. Regarding the China fight, the service's argument was unfair to the rest of the force. Of course, the Navy would play a much larger role in the Pacific, but to win against China, or any adversary for that matter, a joint approach incorporating the Army, Air Force, Marines, Space Force, Cyber Command, and others was necessary. These were the things that I, as Secretary of Defense, had to balance. I wasn't opposed to allocating more of the budget to the Navy, but before making any adjustments, I wanted to do three things. First, I wanted to approve an updated war plan for the Indo-Pacific so that I knew how the commander planned to fight and win. That would give me a better sense of what the services needed to procure. Second, I wanted a new joint warfighting concept so that I better understood how we planned to conduct warfare in the coming decades and how that would affect the force mix. And finally, I wanted to see internal reforms by the services. We had an obligation to spend the American taxpayers' dollars well. It is too easy to forget about that and ignore the hard work of reform when Congress is showering dollars down on you. I needed to see that commitment first, and it was important that others inside and outside the Pentagon saw it too. After my February 2020 House Armed Services Committee hearing, Representative Joe Courtney, Democrat from Connecticut, complained about the lack of a shipbuilding plan and the Trump administration not delivering a strategy to build a 355-ship Navy. Although he was being both partisan and parochial, he was right about this. I couldn't account for my predecessors, however. It was true that the Navy was prioritizing readiness over growth for all the right reasons. Admiral Gilday was concerned about having a hollow Navy, and so was I. I committed to deliver a credible plan to build a bigger, better Navy, but I wasn't going to be cowed into submitting a plan I didn't support. Many people in Washington who were involved in Navy issues often cited Trump's support for a 355-ship fleet as talking point number one to increase the Navy budget. It was true, but in my nearly 18 months as Secretary of Defense, the President never raised this issue with me. Rather, he complained constantly about the USS Ford and how overpriced and broken the carrier was. The catapults don't work, which wasn't true. The elevators are broken, which was partially true. And the island on the flight deck from where air operations and other ship functions are controlled looks really bad, it's stupid, because it was positioned too far aft of ship instead of near the middle. I had answers to these gripes. I had visited the Ford in Norfolk early in my tenure and tried to explain the issues to the president multiple times. He listened, but never heard. The most important thing always seemed to be about the image and the look, as he called it. With the USS Ford, it was such an issue that he proposed we move the island closer to the middle of the ship. Imagine the time and cost to do that. As he spoke about it, Trump would gesture with his hands, parallel to each other, farther apart, then closer, like a football referee measuring the distance in inches or feet to get a first down. He then pressed several times to cancel the entire multi-ship purchase, often throwing his hands up in the air as he said it, and then tucking his head and waving his hand in a "forget it" gesture to show his frustration. "It looks horrible," he said, "and it will never work." He said he once spoke to a chief petty officer on the Ford who agreed that the new catapults were bad. "Steam," he told me. "He prefers steam catapults," Trump would say, emphasizing the word steam with an exaggerated pronunciation as he said it. With regard to the elevators, The president recounted his experience with this type of system from his real estate days. "One glass of seawater, just one, that's all it will take. Once it splashes on those elevators, they'll never work," he would say in a disgusted manner, arms out to his side like a polar bear, once again shaking his head in disapproval. The Navy disagreed. Nonetheless, I shared his frustration with all the dollars the service was sinking into the Ford and the continual delays. On multiple occasions, the president complained that the U.S. Navy ships look ugly, while the Russian and Italian ships, for example, look nicer, sleeker, like a real ship. Maybe so, but as I told the president in defense of the Navy, our ships are built to fight and win, not win beauty contests. We prize function over form. That didn't satisfy him. In retrospect, it probably angered him. He wanted to see ships that looked more like yachts. At his request, I once brought along a picture book of ships from various navies, laying it out on the Resolute desk in front of him. He would flip through the pages like a billionaire shopping for a new yacht, naturally, studying each and every one. He would point out features he liked. "See that line?" he'd say. "It's nice and clean," as he passed his index finger slowly across the ship's picture from the bow to the stern. On more than one occasion, the Navy had to bring over their ship experts to the White House to explain the design of our surface vessels. It never made a difference. These were the Navy issues that kept Trump's attention, not building a 355-ship fleet. It was such a waste of time. Robert O'Brien was a self-stylized navalist who also believed in growing the Navy. He didn't have any practical background, but was passionate about the topic. At one point, very early in the administration, it was reported by many he was actively lobbying to become Secretary of the Navy. That said, he was helpful in managing the president's desires to kill the Ford-class carriers, but presented his own hobby horses that I had to beat back, such as spending up to $500 million per ship to resurrect a half-dozen mothballed Perry-class frigates from the 1970s. He wanted to put them in the water simply to raise the ship count for a few brief years, it seemed. This wasn't the way to grow capability either. We would have wasted over $3 billion simply to say we had more ships than the Obama administration. Too often, people get fixated on the number of ships. Quantity is important, but so are quality, capability, affordability, and sustainability. These were things O'Brien, who in his role as national security advisor with no budget, program, or operational responsibility, let alone actual experience, didn't seem to appreciate. Over time, once he had a peek at the future naval force we were designing at the Pentagon and how we built these factors into the plan, he became so enamored with it that he began to claim it as his own, I was told, overstating his personal involvement behind the scenes to others and a gullible press. These were the dynamics of Navy shipbuilding with which I had to deal, as I'm sure some of my predecessors did as well. The challenges we faced building a future fleet were sharper than most other issues, it seemed, but epitomized the constant headwinds we confronted across the DoD when it came to modernizing the force. The internal politics of the Navy, its various tribes and friction between its civilian and military leadership over future structure, especially with regard to aircraft carriers, a focus from some in Congress that was all about jobs and maintaining the status quo rather than helping the DoD make tough decisions and build a truly capable Navy, the internal politics of the White House and the interests and ambitions of the various players, including an Office of Management and Budget that wanted to trim defense spending, and the hidden role that industry, unions, associations, retired officers, and others played as liaisons among these groups and as advocates on behalf of their programs. All these factors, individually and in combination, hurt the department, hindered our warfighting capabilities, and weakened our national security. I wondered if my counterpart in Beijing faced similar challenges. We needed to build a Navy larger than 355 ships, beginning with more attack submarines. We also needed aircraft carriers, no doubt, but I wasn't convinced that we had the size, type, or number right. Richard Spencer's idea of building light carriers had a lot of appeal, and it could help address the incessant requests of combatant commanders. A mix of both made sense. It gave you more options and capacity, and it would be more affordable, especially if you deployed nuclear-powered carriers against your higher-end and most complex adversaries, and deployed light carriers toward the other end of the spectrum. Given all these factors, I could not accept the Navy's plans. They seemed to be a product of internal Navy log-rolling among the various tribes, surface, subsurface, aviation, etc., to keep their share of the Navy budget largely unchanged. Insiders were confirming this to me. The plan also seemed trapped in the warfighting constructs of the past, not adequately reflecting where we needed to be in a future fight against China. I turned to Deputy Secretary of Defense David Norquist to lead a study to assess a range of future fleet options designed to maintain our overmatch. The team included participants from the Navy, Marine Corps, Joint Staff, and the OSD, as well as outside advisors and experts. They began their work in the spring of 2020. As the team looked at different solutions, I wanted their future fleet proposal to optimize the following attributes: distributed lethality and awareness, survivability in a high-intensity conflict, adaptability for a complex world, ability to project power, control the seas, and demonstrate presence, and finally, the capability to deliver precision effects at very long ranges. At the same time, I told them the fleet design must be affordable in an era of tight budgets, sustainable over the long term, and operationally ready and available at higher rates. These were all issues we currently faced and would continue to deal with. What they developed was a more balanced Navy of over 500 manned and unmanned ships that we called Battle Force 2045. The work was a testament to Norquist's inclusive style and analytical approach, so much so that he and later Navy Secretary Braithwaite was able to get the CNO and the Navy's senior leaders on board. The plan would reach more than 350 traditional line ships prior to 2035, the year China aimed to fully modernize its military. And the entire battle force would be completed by 2045, 4 years prior to Beijing's goal of building a world-class military. Importantly, we had a credible path for reaching these numbers in an era of fiscal constraint. Under the proposal, Battle Force 2045 would comprise a much larger and more capable submarine force. There was a broad consensus on this, and I publicly said, if we do nothing else, we should invest in attack submarines. The Navy must begin building 3 attack submarines a year as soon as possible. Subs were the clear advantage we had to sustain, and yet current plans didn't put sufficient value on them. The tough issue was the aircraft carriers. We made clear that nuclear-powered carriers would remain our most visible deterrent, but we didn't need to build an entire Navy around them, and we needed to take a serious look at light conventional carriers. The study pointed to as few as 8 big carriers complemented by up to 6 light ones, which seemed like a good mix, especially if you readjusted the existing basing plans for carriers to better meet the more demanding operational needs in the Pacific. The future force would comprise between 140 and 240 unmanned and optionally manned surface and subsurface vessels that could perform a wide range of missions, from resupply and surveillance to mine laying and missile strikes. These ships would add significant offensive and defensive capabilities to the fleet at an affordable cost in terms of both sailors and dollars. We just needed a reluctant Congress to give the Navy the authority to develop these systems more aggressively. Next, we determined that the future fleet needed more and smaller surface combatants. Adding 60 to 70 lighter combatants would not only increase capacity to conduct distributed maritime operations, but also free other critical assets for more efficient mission distribution. We also made strategic lift and logistics vessels a priority. They are key to getting ground forces to the fight and sustaining distributed operations, so I felt strongly that they should be included in the study. I also didn't want the Navy or Congress to forget about them. Success in conflict can come down to simple logistics, but it's not sexy, and so it's often overlooked, until it matters. We knew that Battle Force 2045 would be a more lethal, survivable, adaptable, sustainable, and larger force than we have seen in decades. It was the naval force needed to deal with China. Achieving it over the long run would not be easy, however. Parochial interests, budget uncertainties, infighting, industrial capacity, and other competing factors would challenge us. Money was always an issue, but once Secretary Braithwaite came aboard in May 2020, he was committed to making reforms that would free up billions of dollars. With that good faith effort, I decided to match his initiative with funding harvested from ongoing DOD-wide reform efforts. If the department pursued all these initiatives, and Congress made some adjustments as well, such as returning unspent appropriations dollars to the Navy rather than letting them expire, we could match the average percentage of dollars spent annually for new ships during the Reagan buildup. We wouldn't be able to begin building more ships for a few years, but starting was achievable in the next five. It would take that long for the shipbuilders to improve shipyard capacity and grow their workforce to meet demand, they told me when I met with them. I introduced Battle Force 2045 in a major speech on October 6, 2020. Norquist and his team, along with Braithwaite and the Navy, had done extraordinary work over the previous half year to get to this point. In the final weeks, though, O'Brien and the NSC were nipping at both men's heels for more information, suggesting that the White House unveil the initiative. Chief of Staff Mark Meadows even got involved. Indeed, he and I got into a yelling match not long after I briefed Battle Force 2045 to the public. He had the nerve to ask in a phone call, "Who are you to make a major announcement about the Navy?" "I'm the goddamn Secretary of Defense," I shouted back as I stood above the secure phone at my desk. There was a brief pause. I imagined him turning red and eyes watering, as so often happened when he was confronted. And then he said, "Who gave you the authority?" "The Senate confirmed me, and Congress gave me full authority, direction, and control over the Department of Defense under Title 10 of the law. That's who," I charged back. He really wanted to know who at the White House gave me the approval to move forward. I didn't need anyone's approval, as I said. Moreover, my future naval force structure plans were wholly consistent with Trump's views on building up the military. In a normal administration, I would have briefed the relevant players and coordinated our rollout plan in advance. But I couldn't risk doing that with this White House team, however. Mark Meadows became Trump's fourth chief of staff in March 2020. Meadows hailed from North Carolina and was elected to Congress in 2012. He is a Tea Party Republican who quickly established himself as a founder of the ultra-conservative House Freedom Caucus. In his early 60s, with gray hair, a slight heavyset, and a ruddy look at times, he is a 100% Trump loyalist. He seemed committed to two things: getting the president reelected and doing what the president said. It was never clear to me which of those two came first, but there were indications at times that his own personal political ambitions and policy aims factored into both as well. With my last response to Meadows, he went silent. I hung up. I couldn't believe these were the things I had to argue about with the White House. I looked up at the portrait of George C. Marshall that hung above my desk and shook my head in amazement after this call with the White House Chief of Staff. Did Marshall have to deal with such BS as well? I wondered. This was why I didn't want anyone in the White House involved at this point. Battle Force 2045 was a serious piece of work done by a committed group of defense professionals. My concern was that allowing the NSC to get involved, especially a few weeks before the election, would politicize it. We already saw that happening. Building upon the reported fundraisers O'Brien attended alongside Trump for many months, he was now making solo political trips throughout the fall, and nearly right up to November 3rd. On October 21st, the National Security Advisor traveled to Portsmouth Naval Shipyard in Maine. During his remarks, he said the U.S. Navy plans to put hypersonic missiles on all Arleigh Burke-class destroyers and new attack submarines. Oh, really? Who in the Navy said that? I called up Navy Secretary Braithwaite after I read about it in the paper. He was unaware of this. It looked like O'Brien was freelancing again. Even the media was smart enough to know that doing this would be a significant expense and would likely tie up shipyards for years to come, as one article read. An expert from a prominent think tank called it a terrible idea. One theory was that, after denied the chance to roll out Battle Force 2045 personally, he was looking for other ways to burnish his credentials and position himself to be the next Secretary of Defense. Less than a week later, on October 26th, O'Brien was on the road again, this time visiting Fincantieri Marinette Marine Shipyard in Wisconsin, an important electoral state. He toured the facility and gave a speech highlighting the Navy's award of a $795 million contract to the company to begin building the new Constellation-class frigates. These trips by the National Security Advisor weren't the DOD's idea, but I was concerned that his visiting key states just weeks before the election and talking about the military risked tainting the apolitical reputation of the armed forces I was working hard to maintain. We were concerned about guilt by association, especially when the speaker not only talks about contract awards, but also suggests the Trump administration will spend millions building more ships in their state if they vote for him. These visits raised serious questions from government ethics experts and watchdog groups about potential violations of the Hatch Act and other improprieties, though I don't believe any charges were ever brought against him or others. It all just seemed improper and unnecessary. Meanwhile, O'Brien was reportedly leaking to the press that he was the driving force behind the plan to modernize and expand the Navy. Indeed, on December 9th, after I left office, he co-authored an opinion piece with the director of the Office of Management and Budget, touting our future fleet plans. Such a piece should have been written by a senior Pentagon official. For nearly a year, though, O'Brien seemingly wanted to play Navy Secretary from the White House, causing a good deal of personal friction with Navy Secretaries Spencer and Braithwaite. Now here he was trying to claim ownership of Battle Force 2045, despite never having been involved with the study. It was complete BS, yet Politico and others bought the story hook, line, and sinker. I simply wasn't concerned about the administration getting credit for this future fleet initiative by the fall of 2020. I just wanted Congress to embrace the plan we put forward. A White House role would taint it. Battle Force 2045 needed to endure because it was the right naval force structure for the future, and some key stakeholders were now behind it. Moreover, with Beijing rapidly increasing its maritime capabilities, we couldn't afford to lose any more time. Politics aside, which is where we wanted them, Battle Force 2045 was the right way forward for the U.S. Navy and the entire joint force. It was wholly consistent with the NDS, which was driven by the White House's overarching strategy, and it addressed China's plans and ambitions. It was a daunting task, for sure, but we were confident that our plans met the operational and non-warfighting attributes necessary to ensure the Navy's continued success for decades to come. The key now was keeping the Navy in the boat and rowing hard in unison with the OSD, while building industry and congressional support on Capitol Hill to see Battle Force 2045 implemented. I was disappointed to read in June 2021 that the Biden administration's fiscal year 2022 budget request would result in less real spending for the Navy, a 3% reduction for shipbuilding than the previous year. Worse yet, it included funding for only 8 Navy ships, 4 of which are support vessels. This stands in stark contrast to the original FY22 budget we built for Battle Force 2045, which called for 12 ships to be procured, most of which were warships, followed by increasingly more ships annually in years 2023 through 2026. The only way to build a bigger, better Navy, the one we need to retain overmatch, if not dominance, for the next 30 years, is to procure more ships year over year over year. And the only way to pay for it is through increased appropriations for shipbuilding, internal Navy reforms to secure additional funding for the budget lines necessary to sustain a larger fleet, and legislative changes that would allow the Sea Service to keep its unspent dollars and retire older vessels. Failing to do so will mean that we will yield the waters of the Indo-Pacific to China over time, a development that will harm our security, our economy, our diplomacy, our commerce, and the international rules-based order that helps underpin them all. Chapter 8. The Afghanistan Dilemma. The uniformed pallbearers carried the flag-draped metal container slowly down and off the lowered back ramp of the large, gray C-17 transport plane. They marched in quiet unison to a whispered cadence across the concrete tarmac of Dover Air Force Base in Delaware. The old guard soldiers, with the silver rectangular carrying case firmly in hand, first passed a lineup of senior civilian and uniformed officials, two or three rows deep, all of whom either saluted or placed their hand over their heart as the dignified transfer from the airplane to the awaiting transfer vehicle took place. With white-gloved hands, they then carried the fallen hero past the family members seated beneath a small canopy, not more than 40 yards from the rear of the plane, and watched as the case was carefully loaded into the van in front of them. Many sat there stunned. Most wiped away tears throughout. Others at times cried out to the deceased. One final salute was rendered by all as the large, dark gray vehicle slowly pulled away. Everyone held one another tighter. It was always very solemn and very emotional. And the military's act of welcoming home America's fallen sons and daughters one last time from combat abroad always made the nation's far-off conflicts very real for those who had to live with the consequences, especially the families. Getting out of Afghanistan and ending the forever wars was a core Trump promise. One had to give the president credit for wanting to fulfill the commitments he made during the 2016 campaign. We were long overdue for getting out of that conflict. We had spent too much time and too much money and lost too many lives there. During my tenure as Army Secretary, dignified transfer ceremonies at Dover AFB were unfortunately still somewhat common. There was nothing more difficult than to meet the wife or husband of the soldier lost and try to console them while their young children ran about seemingly oblivious to what had happened. The spouses nearly always put on a tough face, though I often imagined they were more in shock than anything else. I usually asked to hear their personal stories, tales that the sterile career summaries we were provided could never capture. You could see a young widow's face light up ever so briefly when she recounted those private moments, where they first met, their wedding day, the birth of their first child, and so forth. Better yet were the humorous moments they shared, when everyone would get a quick chuckle out of a funny story well told, forgetting for a brief moment the nightmare they were now living. Leah would sometimes join me at Dover. She experienced it all through the lens of an Army spouse and mother, remembering the time she saw me off to war and then didn't know whether she might get that slow knock at the door. She was really good with the family members, especially the parents who often attended as well. We ached for them, too, and their sorrow made real that adage that no parent should ever have to bury their child. It was terrible, and no words or gestures could ever truly comfort them. We did the best we could. It was time to end this war. I found writing condolence letters to the families of those killed in action, as well as to the loved ones of those many other soldiers who would die each week from things like car accidents, suicide, or illness, difficult and depressing. As a result, I also started writing happy letters to soldiers recognized for their accomplishments, performing volunteer work in their community, or putting their own lives at risk to help others, among other things. Stories of soldiers rescuing people from a burning house or organizing a major charitable event in their spare time helped offset the losses for me. I would bring this practice with me to the Secretary of Defense's office. I still wrote to families whose sons or daughters were killed in combat, but thankfully, no further wartime deaths in Afghanistan happened during my tenure after we signed an agreement with the Taliban in February 2020. Many uniformed personnel in the Pentagon had strong feelings the other way about Afghanistan. To many, it was unfinished business. It was a place where they had invested significant parts of their lives and careers. Many of them lost friends and colleagues in the mountains and valleys of that tribal country. You had to respect this and admire it as well. Afghanistan was a noble effort, and nobody assigned there had fought in vain. But it was also costly, and distracting us from the bigger, growing challenges of China and Russia. That said, we really needed to make sure that Afghanistan never again became a safe haven for terrorists to plan, prepare, and conduct attacks against the United States. That was the original reason we went there in 2001, and no attacks from that mountainous, landlocked country had occurred in nearly 20 years, so we had an obligation to continue that record. Most Americans probably couldn't find Afghanistan on a blank map before the tragic events of September 11, 2001. That horrific day shook our nation and our sense of security unlike any other except Pearl Harbor. In contrast to the surprise attack on December 7, 1941, 9/11 was a ruthless assault by terrorist hijackers against civilians. It was mass murder on a scale we had never seen before. We were all vulnerable now, it seemed. Since that terrible day, and the Bush administration's subsequent decision to eliminate al-Qaeda and the Taliban government that was protecting them, the United States invested a great deal of its time, resources, and people to help the Afghans organize a new government, establish a democracy, and build a country. The United States was joined in this endeavor by many other nations, primarily from Europe, who wanted to see Afghanistan become a normal state that could sustain and protect itself. Beginning with the Taliban's ouster in late 2001, the U.S. troop presence grew from 2,500 that December 2001 to 100,000 by August 2010. In short, as the Taliban grew and combat operations increased, so did the U.S. troop presence, as did U.S. casualties. The numbers would begin to decline year after that as the United States changed its strategy and Afghan security forces played more of a role. By the time President Obama left office in 2017, U.S. forces in Afghanistan totaled around 8,400. In August 2017, Trump announced plans to deploy additional forces to Afghanistan, increasing the number to about 14,000. This move ran completely counter to remarks he had made on the campaign trail. The media quickly jumped on this reversal, citing a range of his past comments such as, "Let's get out of Afghanistan. Our troops are being killed by the Afghanis we train and we waste billions there. Nonsense." In announcing his turnaround, Trump declared, "Conditions on the ground, not arbitrary timetables, will guide our strategy from now on." Nevertheless, as with so many things in the Trump administration, that would change again. By the time I became Secretary of Defense in July 2019, Trump wanted out immediately. He would continually claim Jim Mattis talked him into deploying more troops, promising that the war would be over on his watch. He would mock the former Secretary of Defense's comments about the Afghans' commitment to their country, mimicking Mattis by dipping his chin to his chest and lowering his voice to say, "Sir, they are fighting for their country," and, "They are great fighters." Trump would then respond to himself, saying back to everyone gathered around him, "They only fight because we're paying them," and claimed, "They are the highest paid fighters in the world." Trump would go on to complain about the trillions of dollars we wasted in that hellhole and how corrupt the Afghans were, especially President Ashraf Ghani Ahmadzai, often citing without proof the extravagant mansion he owns in Dubai. Trump was certainly right about the corruption in Afghanistan. It was rampant and reached from the highest persons in the country to the lowest. In Trump's view, Mattis was a terrible Secretary of Defense who duped him by promising victory on one hand and, on the other hand, warning that if we didn't fight the terrorists in Afghanistan, we would be fighting them in America. Mattis had boxed him in, the president complained, and never delivered on anything. This was another example of how Trump's views of a person could swing from one extreme to another, and usually, eventually, for the worst. I first learned of the near-final deal between the Taliban and the United States in late June 2019, not long after the president named me acting Secretary of Defense. Few in the DOD were aware of the arrangement that Zal Khalilzad, a seasoned Afghan-born diplomat appointed by Secretary of State Pompeo to be the U.S. Special Envoy to Afghanistan, was negotiating to find a peaceful resolution to the war. I was fully in favor of crafting a political end to the conflict. Nobody but for the Afghans themselves paid a heavier price than our military personnel. The contours of the plan briefed to me by Pompeo still lacked some key details and had little support across the interagency, meaning the other relevant departments and agencies of the executive branch. I pressed Mike about circulating the draft for review. I was new to the club at that time, so it wasn't clear to me yet that there was a lot of tension between him and then-National Security Advisor John Bolton. Pompeo was fully on board with sharing the draft with the DOD. He invited General Dunford and me to a detailed brief on July 15, 2019, at the State Department. We sat in a small conference room where others on his team joined us, including from abroad via secure video. They walked us through the deal as it stood, the expected next steps, and the likelihood of success on the key sticking points. Mike would often say, matter-of-factly, in his baritone voice, twiddling a pen, as he did, "None of us trust the Taliban, and it's not a perfect agreement, never will be, but that we need to get them talking." I agreed. Peace was certainly worth the chance. There was not going to be a military solution to Afghanistan that would ever meet our aims. Mike had a good sense of humor, often accompanied by a short, half-smiled chuckle. But meddling from the National Security Council really angered him. He ranted to me about it on a couple occasions. The NSC had a historical reputation for getting too much into DOD and other departments' business, so I empathized. In his view, though, the NSC didn't want to study the plan as much as kill it. Putting it into the NSC process would give Bolton and his team a chance to dissect it and leak its shortcomings to the media, and the Afghanistan hawks on Capitol Hill who would then oppose it, Pompeo said. I was still new to the team. The Senate had not even confirmed me at this point, so I soaked in Mike's assessment and thought about the DOD's role in this unfolding drama. In addition, if NSC staff was quick to leak sensitive information involving state, then I should expect similar treatment for defense. Time would prove out this conclusion. Mike was right about GOP opposition on the Hill, but the other fact was that most lawmakers from both parties wanted to see the United States leave Afghanistan. We understood this, too. Leaks were a chronic problem in the administration. Much of the information being disclosed to the media at the time seemed to be coming from the White House and was focused on internal policy disputes. Afghanistan, Syria, Turkey, and Venezuela, for example. This was Pompeo's concern. Soon it would be mine as well. The individual motivations for the leaks ranged from advancing a preferred policy outcome, to enhancing the leaker's own role or credentials, to currying favor with the president. It was a noxious behavior learned from the top. The president was the biggest leaker of all. It turned colleague against colleague, department against department, and it was generally bad for the administration and the country. By early 2020, leaks coming from the West Wing had become far more personal in nature. Attacks on others within the executive branch to settle scores, position themselves for future jobs, or to burnish their own record by denigrating colleagues. Alex Azar had NSC staff constantly alleging to the press that he was mismanaging the Department of Health and Human Services and its response to COVID. They also stirred the pot between Azar and the administrator for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Others attacked CIA Director Gina Haspel for allegedly maintaining ties with senior officials from the prior administration. Someone after me for not being loyal to the president or not fully supporting his narrative on a variety of issues. Meanwhile, leaks about plans and policy matters were on the rise at the Pentagon. Whether planning to deploy additional troops to the Middle East or reducing our footprint in countries such as Iraq, some government employees who felt differently leaked information, often classified, to the media. In many cases, these were just options under development at a much lower level for the DOD's leadership to consider. The problem of illegal leaks became so bad and had jeopardized our national security so much that I felt compelled to launch a DOD-wide investigation in the summer of 2020. This was accompanied by a sustained effort to remind our uniformed and civilian employees of their obligations to protect classified information and to educate them on why and how best to do so. None of this was about muzzling whistleblowers or clamping down on the activities of a free media, as a few alleged. It was all about curtailing the unauthorized release of classified information that harmed our nation's security or put our troops at risk, while also weakening the trust and confidence our foreign partners had in us. In other cases, people leaked one-sided information to Capitol Hill or to the press in order to undermine options under internal consideration to reform the Pentagon, trim the budget, or cancel programs that had outlived their usefulness. This aspect was less about strategy and policy, and more about their own agency budgets, missions, or jobs. Either way, it was detrimental to internal deliberations aimed at doing what's best for the DoD and the country. These leaks also damaged trust within the building, making people far more reluctant to speak up and share their views. Nobody wanted to see their name in the morning news, especially when the words were so often twisted, misinterpreted, or taken out of context. In the Trump administration, this could get you blacklisted or fired. Very early in my tenure, I took a scheduled call from John Bolton. As I was about to pick up the phone, a half dozen people, military assistants, policy experts, and strategy managers, for example, piled into my office to listen in and take notes. I was baffled. I felt perfectly capable of taking my own notes, and I didn't want either Bolton or me to feel constrained because there was an audience on the line as well. We needed to have candid conversations. For example, the privacy of these calls enabled me to get agreement from Bolton and Pompeo to stop reaching out directly to my commands or my leaders, which had become a problem by the time I took the helm of the DoD. These calls were also good opportunities to discuss politics, share rumors, or maybe even commiserate. Staff didn't need to be in on all of this. Moreover, I didn't want my team accused of leaks. I asked everyone in my office to leave, which became the new standard for my phone calls with cabinet members. Ironically, someone later leaked this change to the media and anonymously, of course, suggested it was an example of me not wanting my staff to hear when Bolton, Pompeo, or others told me how to run the DoD. How ridiculous. Worse yet is the fact that someone in the media would even print such a fabricated story. This was how low things were becoming. The bottom line is that I didn't want to get in the middle of the feud between NSC and State. I was friends with Mike and John, having worked with them both in the past, and would need their support to be successful. More importantly, we needed to make our organizations and engagements work for the good of the country. At the time, I simply wanted to ensure the DoD had the opportunity to scrub the Afghan peace plan in detail and talk with Zal before it was finalized. Pompeo was completely on board with this. My team received a draft not long after Dunford and I met with the Secretary of State. Its high points included a commitment by the Taliban to take a series of steps to prevent any group or individual, including Al-Qaeda, from using the soil of Afghanistan to threaten the security of the United States and its allies. The required actions included preventing terrorist groups from recruiting, training, and fundraising in Afghanistan, not issuing them visa, passports, or travel permits, and directing Taliban members not to cooperate with any such groups or persons. John Rood, the Undersecretary for Policy, had serious concerns about the plan. In his view, the agreement was heavy on commitment by the United States to withdraw its forces down to zero, but light on how the Taliban would deliver on their obligations to break from Al-Qaeda and work in good faith on a peace agreement with the government in Kabul. John made very good points, but not everyone shared his views. Regardless, I asked him to go back to Zal and look for ways to tighten up the areas that concerned him. The biggest issue at the principal's level was the obligation to withdraw all U.S. military personnel from Afghanistan by May 2021. I didn't support an arbitrary timeline. We all agreed that the Taliban couldn't be trusted to hold up their end of the deal. Meanwhile, the two biggest levers we had over them were the U.S. military presence and our ability to inflict violence upon them. These were also the most important things to the Afghan government, in addition to U.S. economic assistance, logistical and maintenance support, and the $5 to $6 billion we paid them annually to man, train, and equip their forces. Rood came back to me with additional concerns about going to zero U.S. troops. If we did that, he argued, setting aside an arbitrary date, then how would we be able to maintain a counterterrorism presence in the country? In my view, if the Taliban lived up to their end of the deal, broke with Al-Qaeda, denied them safe haven and committed to keeping terrorist groups out of Afghanistan, then we shouldn't need a counterterrorism force there. I thought that was unlikely to happen, though, which is where a conditions-based catch-all would once again kick in and allow us to suspend our departure and even return troops. The key for me was to get agreement that our departure would be conditions-based, and to make that known publicly and privately, especially with the Taliban. We also needed Trump on board with this. Once we had that catch-all covering the entire deal, then I could get on board. The fact was that General Scott Miller, our commander in Afghanistan, was in the process of reducing the U.S. footprint in country anyway, from around 13,500 to something much lower. He wasn't giving away capability. He simply found organizations and people that weren't critical to the mission and started sending them home as an efficiency and force protection measure. He wanted to go deeper, down to 9,000 or so, but this would involve consolidating some of our bases. In my view, if we could get the Taliban to agree not to attack our forces while we implemented a reduction we had planned to do anyway, that would be a good thing. This was another reason to support the deal in my mind. What was interesting, however, was the position I found myself in between the president and my own civilian political appointees. Trump wanted out of Afghanistan immediately, but didn't want to sign a bad deal. Nobody ever wants to sign a bad deal, but this really didn't make sense, given what was on the table. If the president wanted completely out, and the Taliban were promising not to attack us while we did so, then why not sign up for that? For Donald Trump, however, the words bad deal were a trigger to stop acting, stop thinking, and go in a completely different direction. I didn't support signing on to bad deals either. I just found it hard to reconcile his position. On the other hand, my policy shop argued this plan wasn't a good deal because of the commitments we were making up front and the lack of detail underlying the actions the Taliban had to take. Pompeo and Khalilzad were clear-eyed about the agreement's shortcomings and were not necessarily optimistic about its prospects, which were views I shared, but at least it started us down a different path than we had been on the past 19 years. It was worth a try after nearly two decades of fighting and over 2,300 Americans killed. The bottom line for me was simple. The only way the conflict in Afghanistan would ever end acceptably was going to be through a political agreement between the two warring parties. There was no obvious military solution. We had tried that. This wasn't a great deal. It wasn't even a good deal. For me, though, it was a good enough deal. Good enough, that is, to get the process moving forward, get both sides in a room, get them all talking, and see where it goes from there. I used to say to the media that it would be a long, winding, bumpy path with plenty of ups and downs and starts and stops along the way, but the important thing was that everyone kept moving forward. Maybe more importantly, I didn't see Afghanistan as a strategic priority beyond ensuring it never again became a safe haven for terrorists to attack America. We needed to focus on China and Russia. To do that, I needed to shift time, attention, and resources to the Indo-Pacific, as well as to reposition forces in Eastern Europe. So, as imperfect as it was, I supported the State Department's efforts to negotiate a peace agreement. On Friday, August 16, 2019, just 3 weeks after the Senate confirmed me, the National Security Team met with Trump at his Bedminster, New Jersey golf club. Acting Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney was already on site, along with Gina Haspel and White House legal counsel Pat Cipollone, when General Dunford and I arrived. It was a little strange driving onto the club grounds in black Suburbans and exiting the cars in dark suits and uniforms, while Bedminster members of all ages frolicked in the nearby pool and foursomes golfed on the other side of the clubhouse. John Bolton arrived a little after us. He had come aboard Air Force Two with Vice President Pence. John and I quickly said hello, and he pulled me aside to ask quietly, "When did you find out about this meeting?" "Yesterday," I said. He paused, told me that he had just found out this morning about it, and said that State was trying to cut the NSC out of the process. He then quickly asked my views of the Afghan deal. While we were talking, a White House aide called out that POTUS is en route. We moved toward our chairs. The meeting began a little after 3 p.m. in a security tent erected inside a large empty wing of a club building to protect us from electronic eavesdropping. The tent was no longer than two picnic tables in length, with just enough room on the sides for people to walk by and grab their seats. The president arrived in good spirits, dressed in a white shirt, blue sport coat, and slacks, and took his seat at the end of the narrow table nearest the entrance. I sat next to him with Dunford to my right. Pence, Pompeo, and Bolton sat opposite me, in that order. After Trump greeted everyone, Pompeo kicked off the discussion by outlining Zal's efforts over the previous months and then hitting the key points of the agreement. The Secretary of State was realistic about the proposal and presented a sober assessment of its prospects, adding that it was not a perfect deal and he did not trust the Taliban. Trump asked a few questions, zeroing in on the unequal numbers of prisoners listed for exchange between both sides. The president didn't think that a 5-to-1 exchange made sense. "Not a fair deal," he said. I looked across the table at Bolton, furiously taking notes on a large legal pad. When the conversation turned to me, I told the president that the DOD supported the plan, contingent on a conditions-based approach. I also added in my 2 cents about not trusting the Taliban, but thought the deal was good enough to give peace a chance. "We can always hit pause if the conditions aren't being met," I added. General Dunford agreed. I had consulted with him and the military chain of command a few times leading up to this moment, and they were on board with my approach. "Besides," I said to the group, "we were in the process of reducing our numbers anyway." It was clear that Bolton opposed the agreement. John cited specific concerns about the May 2021 departure date for U.S. forces, especially the fact that no residual counterterrorism capability would remain in country if implemented as written. All agreed that this would be a major issue on Capitol Hill for such Republican hawks as Lindsey Graham, Tom Cotton, and Liz Cheney. But what would the Democrats say and do? We didn't stay on topic long at any point during the meeting. Trump started bouncing from issue to issue, getting more and more fired up as he ranted about corruption in Afghanistan, Ghani's alleged mansion in Dubai, and inevitably, his complaints about Jim Mattis. He then leaped around the world like a bullfrog jumping from lily pad to lily pad. The president disapprovingly asked why we were putting more troops in Poland, asking, "Do we really want a Fort Trump there?" "He already agreed to both," Bolton reminded him. The president complained there were too many U.S. troops in Europe and that NATO is ripping us off. I told the commander-in-chief that our troops going to Poland were rotational forces, not permanent ones, that help deter the Russians and reassure our allies, and that I was initiating a global review of our military footprint around the world. My NATO comment triggered the Germany soundtrack, which was mostly about Chancellor Angela Merkel and how Berlin was not paying its fair share when it came to defense. He told the story about his first meeting with Merkel and how she asked, "What are you going to do about Ukraine?" regarding U.S. military and financial support. To which he quickly responded, as he told it, "What are you going to do about Ukraine?" In his view, Germany was closer to Ukraine than we are, and it's a big buffer for the Germans against Russia. "They should be paying Ukraine more than anyone," he proclaimed. I would hear this monologue several more times during my tenure. The president was wound up now, sitting in his chair, arms alternating between outstretched at his side as he spoke and folded across his chest as he finished a point. He also kept looking up and down the table to read people's reactions. His volume pitched between high and higher. He pivoted from Germany to issues such as leaks in the government, how to handle the media, the U.S. presence in Africa, and military exercises in South Korea. I tried to respond to issues as they applied to the DOD, but the president wasn't listening. I probably should have just sat there quietly like everyone else. He moved quickly from topic to topic as if on autoplay, eventually coming back to the proposed peace deal and the domestic politics surrounding it. I had only been on the job for a few weeks now and had departed for a week-long visit to Asia on August 2nd, so this was my first encounter with Trump in this mode. It wouldn't be my last. Some of the things he was proposing were outlandish, such as a complete withdrawal of U.S. forces from South Korea, or the pullback of all military and diplomatic personnel from Africa. Shut down the embassies in Africa, he often said, and bring our people, U.S. diplomats, home. None of this was in our nation's interests, and as I calmly responded with facts, data, and arguments, I saw some irritation in him. I was the new guy pushing back. I knew right then and there that this job would be far more challenging than I had anticipated, to say the least. Less than a week after the Bedminster meeting on August 22nd, I would have another early dust-up. In my first televised interview, the reporter asked if I considered the press the enemy of the American people. The reporter was clearly trying to gauge my independence by juxtaposing me with Trump, who had already labeled the media an enemy. I replied, "The press is not the enemy in my book." When questioned about Trump politicizing the military with campaign gear at rallies, I added that we don't allow buttons, hats, etc. on military uniforms, period. My first interview as Secretary of Defense ended up catching the attention of the White House, as would many more that followed. But my message to the media was that I was my own man and that I wanted to work with them. The meeting that Friday afternoon in Bedminster ended a little before 5 p.m. without a hard decision. Trump seemed to be leaning toward supporting the agreement, but only if he could pitch it as a wonderful deal. This, of course, was in contrast with his earlier comments. Now he was somehow going to will the bad deal into a wonderful deal. Just as I was figuring out that the quality of the deal was the most important thing to Trump, he was now demonstrating how he could personally, magically, change the character of that deal in his mind. Moreover, I learned one other important thing that day. Near the end of our meeting, Trump said he wanted any public statement we might release about the peace deal to say that the U.S. would be at zero troops in October 2020, just before the election. November 3, 2020 was the lens through which he viewed the agreement. It was an important takeaway for me. The team that had met at Bedminster had a follow-up session in the Situation Room on Friday, August 30th, with Vice President Pence, John Bolton, and Zal Khalilzad, all calling in from abroad this time. The discussion largely picked up where we left off in New Jersey. The principals still held their same positions. Pompeo outlined to the president the final plan as it was at that point, which was mostly unchanged from the version briefed weeks earlier, and he recommended we move forward on it, as imperfect as it was. Trump listened closely. The president looked at the large screen and asked Bolton, who was in Warsaw, "Would you sign it, John?" Trump knew Bolton drew the hardest line on the proposed agreement. "I would not," John responded. He ticked off the reasons, but gave some ground by telling Trump he can support going down to 8,600 troops and then wait for the Afghan elections. "We can decide what to do next after that," he added. Bolton made clear we couldn't trust the Taliban and cited his concerns about the lack of an enforcement mechanism. He made several good points, many the same as my policy team. I, too, was fine with going down to 8,600 and pausing. General Scott Miller was reducing the number of troops in-country anyway. I acknowledged Bolton's position, but restated my view that we pursue the deal provided that further reductions in U.S. forces were conditions-based, and that we stick to that approach. Without it, we would squander the leverage that a continued U.S. military presence and the threat of force gave us. Trump was now more curious than before about the optics of the deal, the reaction of the Democrats, the backlash from Republicans, and the views of his base. As I mentioned earlier, large majorities in both parties on Capitol Hill supported leaving Afghanistan and were looking for a way to do so without losing our hard-fought gains. I spoke up and proposed we invite congressional leaders in to discuss the plan to build some bipartisan support, or at least dampen opposition. There were a couple of positive nods around the table, but otherwise the group sidestepped the suggestion as the conversation moved on. Too many people took their cues from the president, and he wasn't biting. He never really saw the value in this type of outreach, even if it was just for show. This wasn't the last time I would make such a recommendation, nor the last time the president would ignore it. Congressional outreach was such a simple thing to do, and an important one when you are considering a peace deal to end America's longest war, Starting and ending wars are significant decisions for which you want broad bipartisan support, especially if you want to bring the American people along with you. Trump then caught everyone by surprise by declaring, "I want to meet with the Taliban here in Washington." We all sat there stunned for a moment, carefully looking around at one another, and then at him to see if the president was serious. He was. Trump asked Pence what he thought, to which the vice president rightly cautioned that we give the idea more thought. Trump then said he wanted to meet with Ghani, too, proposing separate meetings in D.C. with him and the Taliban leadership. "So we can meet with the Taliban but not congressional leadership?" I thought disgustedly. Ever the showman, Trump believed this would bring great focus to the matter at hand, and, though this was never said, cast him as an extraordinary diplomat and businessman who could close any deal. None of us liked this idea. As the president went around the room, we each tried to dissuade him in different ways. I recommended against it, reminding him that the Taliban have the blood of American service members on their hands, not to mention their role in the death of nearly 3,000 civilians killed on our own soil on 9/11. It was not appropriate for the President of the United States to meet with them, I added, and said, "It will not go over well with the troops and their families." It didn't sit well with me at all. I didn't see how General Dunford or I could possibly participate in this. Bolton broke the serious tone of the room when the president asked what he thought. I knew John long enough to anticipate his view. No way. But he surprised us with a wisecrack about making sure any Taliban that visit the White House first walk through the world's most powerful magnetometer. Everybody got a chuckle out of that, but those of us who understood the ruthlessness of the Taliban knew what they were capable of doing. The president then transitioned to a quick discussion about how to craft the message about his proposed meeting with Ghani and the Taliban. Trump would often look up into the air, chin raised as he searched for the right words, then drop his head and say, "How about the president has agreed to a meeting?" And then, wait, let's say he's looking forward to the meeting. Pence and he went back and forth a couple of times, the vice president, in his even tone, trying to steer Trump in a better direction with suggestions phrased as questions such as, "Would you meet with President Ghani first?" The meeting soon ended with the president's approval of the peace deal and a quick discussion about security assistance for Ukraine. Regarding the visit by Ghani and the Taliban, it was still on, though Trump later put out that he wanted it moved to Camp David and that all of us were to join him. I couldn't believe this was happening. We were actually going to sit down with the Taliban at the president's historic Maryland retreat like old friends? There was no way Dunford and I could join him. The Taliban had killed and wounded more than 20,000 U.S. service members in Afghanistan since 2001, and that's just counting the physical wounds of war. Not only couldn't I personally do it, it would be terrible for any Secretary of Defense or Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff to be sipping tea with these terrorists, especially while we still had troops in a combat zone. It would be breaking faith with them, their families, and our veterans. It was not lost on many of us either that the 18th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks was coming up in a week or so. This idea was terrible in so many ways. On Thursday, September 5th, a car bomb killed a dozen people in Kabul, including an American service member. Trump was furious the Taliban would do this as he planned a meeting with them at Camp David in a few days to finalize the peace deal. In a series of tweets, he both announced the meetings had been planned for the upcoming Sunday and then canceled them, stating that if the Taliban cannot agree to a ceasefire during these very important peace talks and would even kill 12 innocent people, then they probably don't have the power to negotiate a meaningful agreement anyway. With that, not only was Camp David off, but so too were the talks. It also relieved me of a difficult, early decision about what I'd do if faced with the order to join him and the Taliban at Camp David. Peace talks would pick back up in December 2019, however, not long after Trump made a surprise visit to Afghanistan over Thanksgiving. As the talks between the United States and the Taliban ramped up again in Qatar, Zal and team went to work. The two biggest issues they would face were the process of entering into intra-Afghan negotiations and achieving a visible reduction of violence, the issue that prompted Trump to halt the talks in September. On February 5, 2020, I had an update call with my team back at the Pentagon, with General Miller calling in from Afghanistan and General McKenzie from CENTCOM in Tampa. General Miller confirmed that the negotiating teams had reached agreement on a final text, which was what we were hearing in D.C. It was nearly identical to the version State shared with us the previous summer. The Taliban also committed to start intra-Afghan discussions on March 10, 2020. These talks wouldn't begin until September 2020, though, mostly due to disagreements over prisoner swaps. Before the United States signed the agreement, however, we wanted more proof that the Taliban was serious. As such, we required a week-long reduction in violence before inking the accord. If all went well, both sides would sign it on the eighth day. I asked everyone once again for their views and recommendations. General Miller was satisfied with the deal from an operational perspective, given that there were off-ramps, a dispute resolution mechanism, and sufficient military capability remained on the ground. Coming from him, that meant a lot to me. Generals Milley and McKenzie also supported the agreement. I asked General Miller about the Afghan National Defense and Security Forces, ANDSF. He believed that they will support the deal with sufficient handholding. They were the DOD's key partners and our biggest concern. We needed them on board to make the plan a success. They would be instrumental in providing security throughout the country, and for us more specifically. While U.S. and coalition forces provided their own internal protection, the Afghan forces were responsible for external security, and their outer ring of protection at our various locations was very important. Of greater concern were insider threats, the so-called green-on-blue attacks that had occurred in the past when Afghan soldiers turned on their American counterparts and gunned them down in cold blood. This often happened when the Afghans were under stress, General Miller said, and the Taliban was able to get one of their fighters into the local forces or turn a current member. Either way, it was deeply troubling, broke the trust between our militaries, and caused a great deal of turmoil and tension in the ranks. It was one thing to fight and die alongside your Afghan partners. Being targeted and attacked by them was horrendous and unconscionable. Finally, I was concerned about the Afghan army's staying power and willingness to fight. What would happen as our numbers went lower and lower? The ANDSF experienced an inordinate number of desertions every month as it was, but they were still able to field a sufficient number of troops to sustain the fight. And their commandos were very good. Would it all fall apart with the U.S. departure? And what about Afghanistan's political leadership? Would they cut and run too? Corruption was rampant in Afghanistan, and as the saying goes, a fish rots from the head down. President Ghani always seemed more concerned about himself than his country, as were many other senior government officials, it appeared. It was hard to believe the Afghan military, at least the average soldier, would put their lives on the line if the country's political leaders were unwilling to do so. As in most things, it always comes down to leadership, and the Afghan people deserved far, far better than what they had over the years. By mid-February, both sides finalized the agreement. On the 21st of that month, Pompeo announced that we have come to an understanding with the Taliban on a significant and nationwide reduction in violence across Afghanistan. Moreover, he added, upon a successful implementation of this understanding, signing of the U.S.-Taliban agreement is expected to move forward, with the signing to take place on February 29th. It was important to the president, indeed to all of us, that the Taliban demonstrate seriousness regarding this deal, and the reduction in violence was the metric. Moreover, the reduction in violence would also signal whether the Taliban leadership could really exercise control over their fighters. This was something important for us to know. We would quickly find out that they could. By the end of the month, Pompeo was on a plane to observe the signing of the agreement in Doha by Khalilzad and his Taliban counterpart. Meanwhile, I flew to Kabul to speak and stand alongside our Afghan partners and NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg, a symbolic reaffirmation of our support for the Afghan government and our transatlantic allies who bravely served alongside us for so many years. Many Afghans were anxious about the deal. Some were angry that the United States signed it without their participation. Others opposed it outright. The bottom line was that we needed Afghanistan's political elites to get behind this plan. I addressed this in my public remarks. We knew Ghani privately rejected the deal and was reportedly working through proxies to undermine it, despite saying all the right things publicly and privately to us. At the time of our ceremony, he and Afghan Chief Executive Abdullah were locked in a bitter dispute over who had won the 2019 presidential election. Now, from Ghani's perspective, the United States was pushing him into negotiations with the Taliban that could result in a new government where he had no role. As such, we had strong reason to conclude these contradictory behaviors from him would continue long after the ink was dry in Qatar. The U.S. obligations under the agreement included a phased withdrawal of all American and foreign forces within 14 months, which worked out to be May 2021. The first steps called for a reduction to 8,600 U.S. troops and a proportionate cut in number by the Allies over the next 135 days, coupled with the closure of 5 military bases. These actions had already begun, and we were all quite comfortable with this lower number, so the United States had no trouble agreeing to this. The United States and the Taliban also agreed to halt offensive military operations against each other and our allies, although we reserved the right to take defensive actions in support of our Afghan partners if the Taliban attacked them. With that understanding, we would now be able to continue our reductions without the threat of the Taliban attacking us. At the press conference in Kabul, I made clear that we are fully committed to supporting the Afghan forces throughout this process, and that we reserve all the rights of self-defense. For the record, I added that this will be a conditions-based process, and that the standard for me was that Afghanistan again never becomes a safe haven for terrorists to threaten America. We didn't stay much longer after the press conference. The team was anxious to get me to the airport. There was chatter in intelligence channels before departing D.C. about efforts to target me during my visit, which was very unusual. So we took additional security precautions going into and departing Afghanistan and made several other operational adjustments. General Miller personally involved himself in my security. It was one thing to be concerned about my own safety, but I also dragged around many other folks on these trips, so I was particularly concerned about them. We trimmed some of our team before leaving Washington. Jennifer Stewart, my new chief of staff, then spoke privately with the others, and to their credit, they still wanted to make the trip. We all felt it was important to be on the ground in Afghanistan during this historic moment, and to show our support for the Afghan people and the peace process. I was similarly concerned about our traveling press. Jonathan Hoffman, my head of public affairs, briefed them at the airport prior to departing D.C., giving them the choice to go or not. I spoke with them briefly as well. Jonathan told me later that all went, which I respected. Fortunately, the trip happened without a hitch. Jen Stewart took over from Eric Chuning as my chief of staff in January 2020. Jen came from the House Armed Services Committee, where she was the staff director under Representative Mac Thornberry. A graduate of Miami University in Ohio, her home state, she was a strategic thinker and policy expert with a great deal of common sense, keen political insight, and an even keel. She had a big heart and a great smile that the day-to-day grind of the job couldn't suppress. Not only did Jen have many years on Capitol Hill, but she had also worked in the Pentagon previously as a top advisor to General Dunford when he was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. I had also known her for years and felt fortunate to get someone with her stature and skills on the team. She would prove invaluable in the long months ahead. Back at the Pentagon on March 2nd, I informed the press that the United States was beginning to draw down its forces in Afghanistan consistent with the peace deal. Meanwhile, the Taliban announced, "As per the U.S. Taliban agreement, our mujahideen will not attack foreign forces, but our operations will continue against the Kabul administration forces." I commented, as I so often would, that we will take this one day at a time, because the peace process will be a long, windy, bumpy road with all kinds of starts and stops along the way. Such a journey is not uncommon in the history of peace processes that ended wars. However, while you are always skeptical of your adversary's commitment to the deal, in this case we also had to worry about Ghani's reported efforts to scuttle the agreement. Worse yet, we had a second president who was increasingly undermining the agreement. I never believed President Trump bought into the peace plan. He just wanted out of Afghanistan, saying so in nearly every meeting I attended with him on this topic. It was a main reason I would say publicly and repeatedly, as I did not long after the deal was signed, that not only was the deal a conditions-based agreement, but if we assessed that the Taliban was not honoring it, and if progress stalls, then our drawdown likely will be suspended as well. After all, complementing the deal's carrots of sanctions relief, international assistance, diplomatic recognition, etc., that would come to the Taliban, assuming they were part of a new unified Afghan government, if they fully lived up to the deal, were the sticks of a continued U.S. and allied presence in Afghanistan and a resumption of offensive military actions. Regardless, the only variation on Trump's get out narrative was whether he wanted U.S. troops withdrawn by May 2021, per the agreement, by the end of 2020, or prior to the election, as he mentioned in August 2019. Not surprisingly, as 2019 rolled into 2020 and November 3rd neared, getting all or at least most of our forces out of Afghanistan sooner rather than later became Trump's singular focus, not implementing the peace agreement. This was obvious to everyone, including the Taliban, I bet. As such, his words and decisions would squander our leverage with them and undermine the prospects for achieving an enduring peace in Afghanistan that would benefit the Afghan people and better safeguard America's long-term security. Chapter 9. COVID. A tragic, epic fight. As I spoke with the reporters huddled in my small office on the Air Force jet, a news story flashed across the muted screen. Mystery virus hits America. It was early morning on January 22, 2020, and we were flying to Pensacola, Florida, to visit the Navy. News coverage reported on the first confirmed case of coronavirus in the United States. A man in his 30s from Washington State had developed symptoms after returning from a trip to China, which had recorded its first death from the virus less than 2 weeks earlier, on January 11th. A reporter gestured to the story on the screen and, amid the sound of rushing air that noisily occupied the cabin, asked me if I was tracking this person's case. I was not. It had just appeared in the media yesterday, and I had not dug into the details of this unfortunate man's story. This anecdote, however, became fodder for the hard-left partisans who often dominate parts of Wikipedia to characterize it as an example of me downplaying the seriousness of COVID as part of the Trump administration narrative. If only we knew what this new virus really was in January 2020, let alone had a coordinated message regarding it. Nevertheless, we were tracking the virus. The DoD had been monitoring it at least since mid-January, when there were only a few hundred cases worldwide, and none in the United States. In addition to the DoD, the IC was watching the virus. According to Bob Woodward in Rage, Trump was briefed on January 23rd that the intelligence experts had a pretty benign take on the coronavirus, that it was just like the flu, and unlikely to become a global pandemic. Within days, the Defense Department activated its pandemic response plans. By summer, more than 47,000 National Guardsmen and thousands more military medical personnel were committed across all 50 U.S. states and its territories. Tragically, by the end of February 2021, a year after the first death in the United States due to COVID, more than 500,000 Americans had succumbed to the virus. It would be the first global pandemic of its kind in a century. Some of the DoD's first actions in response to the pandemic began on January 29, 2020, 6 weeks before President Trump would declare a national emergency, when the military received the initial plane load of Americans evacuated from China at March Air Reserve Base in California. We quarantined and cared for them for several weeks. This event marked not only the DoD's first public role in the virus, but also the beginning of a close relationship between the DoD and the Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, one that would eventually transition into our joint work together on Operation Warp Speed. Most Americans weren't paying attention to the virus at this point in late January, and many of those who did probably didn't take it seriously enough. The Pentagon did, however. On February 1st, before the first person in the United States would die from COVID, we implemented our global pandemic response plans, as already mentioned. We could see where this virus might go, and we wanted to stay ahead of it. Many of us at the DoD understood from a careful reading of history the devastation that disease can inflict on populations and on military units in particular.